So first, let me start by thanking the organizers for letting me come. It's been a lot of fun so far. Today I'd like to tell you about a series of ongoing works with a variety of collaborators, like Daniele Dorigoni, Gerald Dunn, Peter Karatiev, and Mita Tunsell, about something called resurgence theory in the context of quantum field theory. And hopefully, shortly, you'll know what I mean by the devil's invention. So let's just dive in. All right, so this talk is really about the dark side of perturbation theory. So perturbation theory is the origin of most of what we know about quantum field theories. We know a little bit beyond perturbation theory these days, but perturbation theory is kind of a gold mine, typically, for QFTs. The reason it's so useful is that if we have a quantum field theory with a small coupling constant, let's call it lambda, then we like to think that we can compute observables as a power series in the coupling constant. Okay? So typically there is some leading thing which is independent of the coupling. It might even be classical. Then you can ask an undergrad to compute it for you. Then in principle, there's something that's proportional to the coupling. That might be a one loop computation. You might need a graduate student for that one. They get harder and harder as you go. So if you want to go to a higher loop order, okay, maybe something that two loops, that's typically quite difficult. And eventually we usually just stop or ask computers to help us, but usually we just stop somewhere here because this just gets really hard. And the reason that we're happy with stopping is that if lambda is small, then we think that this is a good approximation to the actual observable because each next term is getting smaller than the previous one. Okay, so this is very standard. But there's a conceptual issue here, which is that we happen to know that for pretty much every interesting quantum field theory, for instance, QED, QCD, and so on, lambda phi 4 theory, if you were to go to high orders in this expansion, then there are very strong reasons to believe that the nth term in the expansion, the coefficient of lambda to the n, Cn, will blow up factorially. Okay? But that means that Cn times lambda to the n, if you go to large enough n, if you go to a high enough order, will blow up, will diverge, no matter how small lambda is. So that means that perturbation theory is actually giving you a divergent series here. Okay? So then that raises immediate questions. If perturbation theory gives you a divergent answer, then, well, we don't normally run into this, right? We just stop here and we're happy. But then why does it work so well? Why does truncating in the first few terms of a divergent series give you something nice? That's the first kind of obvious question you can ask. And I know many of you kind of know this material, but I'll go through it anyway. But another question is, why, in some deep sense, is the divergence even happening at all? Is it trying to tell us something? Is there some information encoded in that? So those are the kind of natural questions you would immediately think about if you see something like this. And of course, the fact that you have to ask these questions has been known at least for 60 years in the context of QFT. Actually, quantum field theorists were not the first one to run into this kind of issue. Mathematicians run into these kinds of puzzles with divergent asymptotic expansions long before that, 200 years ago at least. And historically, this caused an enormous amount of confusion. So for instance, a very eminent mathematician, Niels Henrik Abel, in 1828, in a letter to a friend, wrote the following about divergent series. Divergent series are the invention of the devil, and it is a shame to base on them any demonstration whatsoever. Okay? And yet in QFT, that's typically what we do. We just use them. Okay? Yet for the most part, the results from using them are valid. Indeed, that's what we see in physics as well. And then he wrote that he's looking for the reason which he characterizes as a very interesting problem. Now, he wrote this in 1828, but unfortunately, he died in 1829. So he didn't have very long to look. Okay? If he had, perhaps more of what I'm saying would be very classical, and we would know it. Okay? But he didn't have very long. Okay. So let me tell you the traditional perspective in asymptotic series, like the ones we encounter in quantum field theory. So if you have an asymptotic series, and you look at the nth term in the series, Pn lambda n, at first, and assume that lambda is small, by the way, then at first, the terms get smaller and smaller and smaller, and you're very happy, and usually we just stop somewhere there. Okay? But if the series is asymptotic, what's going to happen is that when n reaches some number which is a order 1 over lambda, lambda is small, so that's n is large, okay, at some critical value, these terms in the sum will start growing. Okay? And that's why the series is divergent. because if you add everything up, you're going to get infinity. Okay? Now, the typical perspective on what to do with this is the following. Okay? Just don't look there. Okay? The same computational rules that tell you how to compute this and give you an answer that we like give you this, but don't look there. Okay? That's the standard perspective. Due to basically Poincaré, more than 100 years ago. Now, it's not crazy, because what's behind this bold don't look there prescription is the following. You can argue that the mistake in not looking there that you make is actually exponentially small. That is, the ambiguities that you get by never asking about what these terms are doing appear to be exponentially small in the coupling constant, something of order e to the minus 1 over lambda. And if lambda is small, that's small. So maybe you don't care. So you might think that therefore whatever I'm going to be talking about is therefore an interesting, I'm cleaning up some exponentially small issues and, you know, why bother? But actually, you know, this scale, e to the minus 1 over the coupling, that's precisely the scale of the non-perturbative physics in theories like QCD, right? And in theories like QCD, the non-perturbative physics is precisely the most interesting part, at least for many questions. So dealing with this is actually important if you want to understand non-perturbative dynamics of QCD-like theories. And so we believe that a more systematic approach than just not looking there is called for, and that's what resurgence theory is about. So how might you organize a more systematic approach? Well, let's start with some regularized path integral expression for a favorite observable, whatever it is. And let's say that we've arranged to have a small coupling constant, lambda. Then if lambda is small, then we can evaluate such an integral here of worked in Euclidean space. You can evaluate this integral using a saddle point approximation. You find all the saddle points, and you expand around each saddle point in fluctuations. And what you get, if you expand around the trivial saddle point with zero action, is the standard perturbative series for the observable. Sorry, I should have written O here instead of Z. Apologize. And then you also get contributions from other saddle points with finite action. Okay, and fluctuations around them. Now, I've just told you that this series is divergent. It's sick in the sense of being an asymptotic series. It turns out that every sum that I've written here is sick in a similar way. So the expansion around the non-perturbative saddle points, each one of them is asymptotic, and in that sense sick. And actually, even the sum over the saddle points itself is diseased in a very interesting way, which is not always appreciated. And I'll talk about that in the last part of the talk. Now, because each one of these sums is diseased, at least naively, the traditional view is that this semiclassical expansion expression for observable has an inherent and irreducible vagueness to it, which is of order e to the minus 1 over lambda. Okay, and this comes from just saying that once the terms start growing, just stop. Okay? The modern approach, which I'll be advocating based on resurgence theory, is that you can view this thing as a trans series, something called a trans series. And objects like this are actually faithful and unambiguous but subtle representations of observables. That is, there's a sense in which this is actually an exact expression for whatever observable you've got under some conditions. So now, for that to be true, okay, for you to cure whatever diseases this has, the only way to do that in the context of an expression like this is for diseases here to be canceled by diseases somewhere there, which would mean that there would be intricate relations connecting the perturbative fluctuations around different saddle points, which is to say there would have to be quantitative relations between perturbative and non-perturbative physics. This is not a new idea. People have been thinking about it since at least the 1960s. But resurgence theory is just its detailed implementation based on the work in the context of mathematics by Jean et al. In the 1980s, and recently in quantum field theory and in the string community, people have started trying to use these ideas to learn about non-perturbative physics from perturbation theory and vice versa. So before I proceed, I have to tell you a language in terms of which you can think about asymptotic series, which look divergent and indeed are. Okay? And that language is furnished by the notion of Borel transforms and Borel sums. So let me go through that briefly in case you haven't seen it before. So if somebody hands you a formal power series whose perturbative whose coefficients blow up factorially for large order, you can take it and define a new auxiliary object where you take each coefficient and divide it by n factorial. Okay? If the original thing is blowing up factorially, then this new thing will have a finite radius of convergence. Okay? Now, this expression is just called the Borel transform of what you started with, and naively has little to do with the original. It's just some other auxiliary thing. Okay? But then, under favorable conditions, you can define what's called the Borel sum of this Borel transform, which is just a particular Laplace transform of it written here. And this integral is chosen in such a way that it cancels this n factorial if you evaluate the integral term by term. Okay? So this object, if the integral exists and converges and so on, has by construction the same expansion, the same perturbative expansion coefficients as this. Okay? On the other hand, if instead of doing the integral term by term, you do the integral on the analytic continuation of this object, and the integral exists, then you will have defined a nice smooth object which is associated to the original perturbative series, called its Borel sum. So you should think of this as just a useful representation of the data in the formal power series. And we're going to be using this language. But the issue for quantum field theory, the reason that, the issue in quantum field theory is typically these kinds of Borel sums don't actually exist for the perturbative series that arise in quantum field theories. The reason for that is the following. So let's just look at a couple of toy examples of factorially growing series and see how Borel sums look for them. So for instance, suppose we have a factorially diverging series whose coefficients are alternating. Okay? Then you can, to compute the Borel transform, you just divide by n factorial, so take this away. And you can convince yourself that the analytic continuation of the Borel transform looks like this. Okay? Now, if you then take this thing and shove it in there, you can see that the integral is going to exist because you integrate from 0 to infinity. This has no singularities along the integration contour. So you just do it. Okay? So this is a case where Borel summation will work in the sense that at least it'll give you some well-defined answer. But often what's going to happen is something more like this in quantum field theory, where you have a factorially growing series, but it's not sign alternating. Then you go and compute the Borel transform, and you find that it looks more like this with the 1 divided by 1 minus the Borel variable t. And now if you take this expression and plug it in here, it has a singularity right on the integration contour, t equals 1. You're going from 0 to infinity. So that's a problem, and the integral doesn't exist. Okay. So this is the typical situation in quantum field theory. And because of this, this 19th century machinery of Borel transforms and Borel sums has a bad reputation, I think, in the quantum field theory community. It doesn't work, okay, as written. Exactly. That's the next slide. You can, very good. Yeah, you can do this, but then it causes a problem. So that's what I'm going to talk about next. That's right. So, okay. So if you want to just go past this, you can. Okay, but at a price. You can deform the contour, the integration contour, and just go around the singularity. But the issue is you can go below the singularity or above the singularity. Suppose the singularity is on the real axis. This contour deformation is, by the way, equivalent to giving the coupling constant a small imaginary part, but either a positive imaginary or negative imaginary. Okay? Well, now this. The integral associated to this contour will exist, will have a well-defined value, similarly for this one. But they're not the same value. That is, the integrals along the two contours differ. And here's how they differ. The Borel sum associated with the plus contour gives you something real plus, let's say, something 2 pi times something imaginary. And the one associated with going below gives you, again, something real minus something imaginary. Okay, so there's a ambiguity in the value that you assign to whatever observable had a Borel transform which had a singularity. Okay, so this kind of thing is one reason to think of why people say that when you neglect the growing parts of asymptotic series, you're making a mistake which is exponentially small because the ambiguity that you get is exponentially small in the coupling constant. Okay, here it is. But if you look at the form of the ambiguity, it's kind of pointing at the guilty party. So this is looking like the contribution of some saddle point with action t star. Right? That's what saddle points of path integrals that have non-zero action would look like when they contribute to observables. Yes?
Singularities of, like, not on the real axis, but somewhere else.
Okay.
There might be other ambiguities, whether you circle them, like.
Very good, very good. Borel's summability in that sense is a red herring. You have to worry about singularities everywhere. I completely agree. So that's true. Okay, but then there will be summation ambiguities associated with other directions, and they're important to understand as well. But this is the case in which it kind of hits you in the face, right? If you want to understand what's happening in the theory for real positive coupling constant, which is often what we want to do, then in this kind of situation, you're just stuck. In these other situations, they're also interesting, but they would be a bit different because you would have resummation ambiguities associated with directions in coupling constant space, which are not real. That's also interesting, but not always what we're interested in. So, very good.
On the real axis and goes up into imaginary axis, circles whatever the possible singularity and goes back. So I'm just saying some simple, very main thing, how I can start picking up different saddle points but like the difference is going to be a residue.
Right, exactly.
It's not necessarily real, right?
Sorry?
Yes.
Yeah, but that's going to contribute to the imaginary part.
Yes.
Yeah.
And maybe it's really as well.
Yeah, so.
No, it's not going to be purely imaginary. So if you're off the real axis, it will be a complex coupling constant.
Yeah,
it's not going to be. The ambiguity is not
going to look like this, because the residue is going to be. It's not going to be a real
worms.
It's going to be telling you about the contribution of a complex action saddle point.
Yeah.
Those are very interesting.
Okay.
I see what you're saying.
You cannot interpret it
as a saddle point with real action, but that is also interesting.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
But
that's
I see what you mean. Yeah.
That's not where you're going.
Yeah. That's right. Thank you for the questions. Now, I've just told you that this seems like it's pointing at the contribution of some non-perturbative saddle point with positive real action. But let me try to make this a little bit more quantitative. Okay, so if there's going to be conspiracies and such resummation ambiguities are going to cancel between the Borel sum of, say, perturbation theory and the contribution of some non-perturbative saddle point, okay, which would look like, e to the minus the action of the saddle point divided by lambda times some power series. If ambiguities here cancel against these contributions, then this perturbative series would have to know quantitative information about this. Otherwise, there's no way they would cancel. Okay, and the point of resurgence theory is it gives you tools to decode this information in perturbation theory. Okay, so for instance, in an example like this, where I have two terms which contribute, perturbation theory and some non-perturbative saddle point, the large order behavior of the perturbative series looks like this. Okay, so take these coefficients, go to large n. The asymptotics look as follows. There's factorial growth. I already told you about that. But the way it's growing factorially is tied quantitatively to the action of this saddle point. Okay? This SNP and that SNP are the same. And then you look to corrections to that. And the corrections to that leading growth are actually telling you about the low order behavior of these coefficients here. So this, let's say, P1 NP is this one. P1 and P, and so on. Okay, so basically, what this is telling you is the reason for the name resurgence. The information about this saddle point pops up, resurges, in the large order behavior of the perturbative series around the trivial saddle point, and vice versa, in fact. Okay, so through the lens of resurgence theory, it turns out that the perturbative and non-perturbative contributions to path integral-like objects are not independent, and they have to be treated together to get an ambiguous result. But this is all general comments, so let me now talk about what all this looks like in QCD-like theories, which is the focus for me. So for QCD-like theories, people have beliefs about what happens in the Borel plane associated to the perturbation theory of QCD. Okay? And the belief is that the Borel plane looks as follows. So there are a wide variety of singularities, but let me focus on the ones on the positive real axis, because those give rise to the kind of resummation ambiguities I've been talking about. So first, there are believed to be combinatorial singularities, which are believed to be related to the number of Feynman diagrams at order n growing as n factorial, roughly speaking. Okay? And the resummation ambiguities due to such singularities in the Borel plane are believed to be of order e to the minus 2 times the instanton action of QCD divided by g squared, g being the Engels coupling. Okay? So that tells you the location of these singularities. But there are also believed to be other singularities, which are actually much more important, called Renormalon singularities, and which are related to the behavior of basically single planar diagrams with n running couplings inserted, which give you n factorial growth. And those resummation ambiguities are actually much, much larger than these, because they involve a factor of the beta function here and survive the large n limit, for instance, whereas this doesn't. Okay. Now, this is not just a formal problem. When people do perturbative QCD calculations for, let's say, collider physics, Renormalon ambiguities arise, and the people parameterize the resulting ambiguities by introducing phenomenological power corrections. So this is not just a formal issue.
So you're saying in the large n limit, the Renormalon becomes perturbative?
No, I'm saying in the large n limit, Renormalons don't go away. Instantons do, right? Renormalons don't. That's all I'm saying. That is to say, for Renormalons, the size of the ambiguities involves e to the minus 1 over g squared n. Whereas for instantons, it's one over g squared. So this goes away at large n because g squared goes like 1 over n. And this does not.
But that statement depends on the supersymmetry, right?
Very good. For supersymmetric theories, things are a bit different. But actually, I don't think it's known what normal ambiguities look like in supersymmetric theories yet.
Well, we don't believe, for example, in n equal 2.
Good. For n equals greater than, so for supersymmetric, four-dimensional supersymmetric quantum field theories with more than four supercharges, we don't believe there to be Renormalons. For four supercharges,
yes,
people believe that there are Renormalons, but they're not particularly well understood. Very good. Here I'm talking about QCD-like theories, and I'm prejudiced, and I'm saying that those theories are a bit too different from QCDs for my purposes. So I don't mean those. Okay? Now, suppose you want to try to understand this. Then you need some inspiration, at least I would need some inspiration. And one inspiration you can take is that in quantum mechanics, actually, forget quantum field theory, just in quantum mechanics, perturbation theory is also asymptotic, typically, especially if you have quantum mechanics with potentials with degenerate minima. And in that context, it is known that the ambiguities due to the asymptotic nature of perturbation theory cancel against ambiguities associated with instanton, anti-instanton events. So because of this, Ed Hooft, back in the early 80s, had a dream, which was that the Renormalons we see in QCD-like theories would be associated to some kind of fractional instantons, which he called Renormalons. And he dreamed that this would be associated to confinement somehow, that Renormalons and confinement would be tied together. By the way, n equals 2 gauge theories, which we believe not to have Renormalons, are also not confining, unless you break n equals 2 down to n equals 1 or something, right?
And we understand that in that particular case, it has nothing to do with fractional instantons. Or at least we believe it has nothing to do with fractional
instantons. Good. Good. Okay. But in QCD, I'm going to argue that it is connected to that. But at least in QCD-like theories. Okay. But the thing is that, well, okay, fractional instantons is a pretty word, but nobody knows what that really means in QCD. We don't know if fractional instantons in QCD on R4, at least none that we really believe. And moreover, there are lots of asymptotically free theories with mass gaps, for instance, that don't have instantons at all. So they certainly wouldn't have fractional instantons. So it's not obvious how this dream would actually be realized, if it is realized. So in recent years, there's been a key development with this, which is that if you take a asymptotically free theory, and find a weakly coupled deformation of it, which in this context was a smooth compactification, such that the theory becomes weakly coupled, but you keep confinement. Then, in that setting, in every example that people have looked at, fractional instantons emerge and indeed allow the application of resurgence theory, and you can see systematic ambiguity cancellations. So this may sound very mysterious, so I want to illustrate it with a concrete example and in a toy model. So the toy model I'm going to talk about for the rest of the talk is the two-dimensional SUN principal chiral model. So this is a quantum field theory, which describes the dynamics of a unitary matrix field, an n-by-n matrix, okay, with a coupling constant, dimensionless coupling constant g squared. And it's just a nonlinear signal model. But the reason it's interesting is that it shares a lot of features with QCD. So it's asymptotically free, just like QCD is. It has a dynamically generated mass gap, again, like QCD. It has a matrix-like large n limit, like QCD, and very much unlike vector-like models, like CPN models. It has an analog of a large n confinement-deconfinement transition, just like QCD. And its perturbation theory is actually known to suffer from the same kind of combinatorial and normal ambiguities that QCD does. Okay? Now, of course, it's in two dimensions and not in four dimensions. That's why it's a toy model. And it has another nice feature. Well, a nice feature of this particular toy model is that it's integrable. So on R2, its S matrix is known. So in that sense, it's easier than QCD. Now, one big difference from QCD, aside from this integrability and the fact that it's in two dimensions, is that this model has no instantons. The way to see this is that if there were instantons, they would be associated to the second homotopy group of SUN because we're in two dimensions. But that's zero. So there's no instantons, no topological instantons. And that looks like a pretty big difference from QCD, because in QCD, certainly, we believe that there are instantons. So this is almost a nice toy model for QCD. Now, I'm going to argue in the rest of the talk that this apparent difference from QCD, no instantons, is actually inconsistent with another statement that I made, which is that it has the same kinds of perturbative ambiguities that QCD does. In fact, resurgence theory is going to demand that there must exist finite action field configurations in this theory, whether or not topology seems to ask you to have them. And using resurgence theory, we're going to find these field configurations. But to get started, the first thing we're going to have to do is to justify using semiclassics in asymptotically free field theory, that is, doing perturbation theory in such a theory. And to do that, we need to find some weakly coupled limit of the theory. But once we do that, we're going to find the analog of fractional instantons in the principal chiral model. I'll be able to show that normal ambiguities are systematically canceled by contributions of these fractional instanton-like configurations that we call fractons. And you can also see that in this model, at least, as well as every other model we've looked at, the configurations that drive normal and ambiguity cancellations are also intimately related to the mass gaps of these theories. So,
sorry, can't you just take SUN divided by ZN, the center, to get some non-trivial topological configuration? Because the center always plays a very important role in confinement.
Sure. So the center will play a very important role for me. I have not considered the SUN mod ZN signal model. I've really considered it. I happen to consider the SUN one, but the fact that it has a non-trivial center will be important for me, so hold that thought.
So if you were doing that, maybe you could put back, you know, these 2D chiral models adding instantons to start with.
It would be interesting to think about what happens if you consider that modification of the model I'm thinking about, but I won't have to do that. So, yes?
Maybe you mentioned this and I missed it. So the model you're going to do, it's solvable, right?
It's integrable on R2, yes. So that people know it's S matrix on R2. In the context in which I'm about to put it, the solution has not been written down. I suspect that it can be done, but nobody's done it.
So I guess the question that I'm saying is that, so once you go along this line, as you say, you would be predicting the existence of non-perturbative settle points that are difficult to identify.
Yes.
But your prediction would be based on assumptions that perturbative expansion is Borel summable.
Yes.
So I guess my question is, could it be that your prediction of the saddle points is just an artifact of your assumption that the perturbation theory is Borel sum?
In the context in which I'm going to be talking, I don't think it's an artifact. But I think that what I'm going to be saying, you can view it as a prediction. And if somebody were to do an integrability-based calculation that would be applicable to the regime I'm about to introduce, I would be very surprised if they did not find the result consistent with what we're saying. So that's all I can say. But for now, and hopefully I can say more as we go on through the talk. Okay. So okay, as most of you have probably guessed, thinking about perturbation theory, which assumes that I have a small coupling constant, doesn't really make a whole lot of sense in a theory with the which is asymptotically free with a negative beta function, like in particular the principal chiral model. So in order to talk about perturbative calculations at all, I'm going to need some kind of weakly coupled limit while keeping the mass gap around, which we believe to be associated to renormalize. And we want this weak coupling limit to be smoothly connected to the limit we really want to understand ultimately, which is the one where the theory is directly on R2 without any deformations. So our approach is to compactify it, the theory. So we start with a theory on R2, and we compactify one of the directions on a circle. Okay? I'm going to think of it as a spatial direction. Okay? Circle of circumference L. Okay? Now, if you do this to an asymptotically free theory, if the circle size is small enough, then the theory is going to become effectively weakly coupled, because the coupling at the scale L is what's going to be important. That's just guaranteed by asymptotic freedom. Okay? So for small enough L, the theory will be weakly coupled. But if you take the most obvious boundary condition on the circle, which is periodic, then it's just like turning on a temperature. And the physics for high temperature is certainly going to be very different from the physics at low temperature. So at high temperature, or small L, with periodic boundary conditions, you can just compute anything you want. In particular, you can compute the free energy. And if you look at the free energy divided by n squared, at large n, that goes like 1. You can actually compute what f is down here. For large L, I don't know how to calculate anything using perturbation theory, but there are a lot of simulations of the theory, and there's also a solution of it using integrability. And from those solutions, we know that the free energy divided by n squared goes to 0 at large n. So that means, at least at large n, that there has to be a phase transition somewhere in between, a large n phase transition. Yes?
Isn't there a thermodynamic beta ersatz solution for the theorem circle?
For that, yes, but as I'm arguing, this is not the setting that I want quite, because the small L physics here, where I can do perturbation theory, is disconnected from the large L physics by phase transition. So even in this setting, indeed, you can appeal to integrability. But I'm about to go to a slightly modified setting.
How can you have a phase transition in quantum mechanics?
Larger.
Okay.
Larger. This is a large N phase transition. Indeed, at finite n, there's a Coleman-Merman-Wagner theorem, and there can't be any phase transition. But at large n, you can.
The model should be solvable at finite n with TA at all.
That's fine, but still, OK, what's going to happen is that at large n, you have a sharp phase transition. At finite n, there's just going to be some crossover. But still, the physics down here will look radically different from the physics up here.
That doesn't mean not solvable.
That doesn't mean not solvable. Sure, that's fine. I'm not saying that it's not solvable. I'm just saying it's not particularly interesting for my purposes, because whatever you learn about what's going on down here will not tell you in any clean way what's going on up here. Because the physics has to look quite different down here than up here, at least if n is becoming sizable. That's all I have. OK, so we want to avoid this kind of thermal deconfinement-like transition at large n, because we want to study a small L theory which is smoothly connected to the large volume limit, even at large n. And to do that, we're going to take advantage of the fact that the principal chiral model has an SUn left times SUn right global symmetry, under which the unitary matrix field transforms by one SUn matrix on one side and another one on the other side. Okay, so this symmetry allows you to define a wide variety of sensible spatial boundary conditions, where upon going around the circle, the field doesn't quite come back to itself, but comes back to itself conjugated by some matrix on the left and some matrix on the right. Okay? Those are reasonable spatial boundary conditions. You could consider them if you want. Now, once you do this, though, I suspect integrability methods can continue to solve the problem, but I don't think anybody's done it with generalized boundary conditions like this. If they have, I'd love to know about it, because that would be great to compare against that. Okay? But that's what we're going to need to do. Well, that's what somebody would need to do to check what I'm saying is integrability. Now, you can turn on these kinds of twisted boundary conditions, but you're working with the theory which we believe to be gapped, with a mass gap. So when L is very large, compared to the strong scale of the theory, compared to the gap, this choice of boundary conditions can't possibly matter. But when L is small, it will matter. And dialing through choices of boundary conditions will parameterize a wide variety of distinct theories. And our claim is that there's a unique choice of twisted boundary conditions, such that the physics appears to be smoothly connected at small L to the large L limit. To check this by some other method other than the ones we're doing, you would have to use either lattice simulations or perhaps integrability techniques. So another way to think about twisted boundary conditions is to work with fields that are periodic and turn on background gauge fields for the global symmetries. It's just a different language, which I will sometimes use in what follows. Now, no matter how you do it, the partition function will, once you turn on these background gauge fields or twisted boundary conditions, will depend on those choices. And then you can ask, what are the desired adiabaticity conditions in terms of the partition function or in terms of the free energy? So the first one is that the free energy better scale like n to the 0 at large n, no matter how large L is. So f divided by n squared should go to 0 for any L. And second, we want the theory to be as insensitive to changes in boundary conditions as possible, because certainly that's true at large L, because of the mass gap. So at small L, you can't have a theory which is completely insensitive to the choice of boundary conditions. The theory knows that it's in a box. The closest we can come to that is to demand that we pick boundary conditions such that at least the first derivative with respect to the boundary conditions vanishes. So we pick boundary conditions which extremize the free energy. And second, we're going to ask that whatever extremum that we have satisfies this property, that the free energy when the boundary conditions are the extremum divided by n squared goes to 0 as you take the large n limit. Okay? So to figure out which boundary conditions accomplish these tasks, all we have to do is turn on the most general choice of boundary conditions, compute the free energy as a function of those boundary conditions, and then extremize. So without going into details of how you do this, it's a completely standard perturbative calculation. What ends up happening is the following. One extremum in the space of boundary conditions is the thermal one, as it turns out, where you just have periodic boundary conditions. Okay, so that's an extremum of the free energy, as it turns out. And at that extremum, you can compute the free energy, here it is, in the limit that L goes to 0, and it goes like n squared. This is the thermal small L limit. Here L is just 1 over the temperature. This is not what we want. Another possibility, well not possibility, but another extremum turns out to be one where there are two matrices that you conjugate the U by. There's a kind of axial twist you can do and a vector twist that you can do where you conjugate by different matrices on the two sides. So the other extremum turns out to be describable by setting the axial twist to 0 and the vector-like twist to a center-symmetric configuration. And the free energy at that extremum turns out to be n-independent, which means that if you divide the free energy by n squared and take the large n limit, that goes to 0. So in this sense, this small L limit is still in the confined phase, at least has a chance to be in the confined phase. I'm twisting by the center, exactly. Exactly.
That's what it was. Question. Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay, and when you do this, here's the flow of the coupling constant. So as a function of momentum, at large momentum, the coupling goes to 0 with the momentum, as you expect. It's an asymptotically free theory. And at small L, the coupling saturates at some value and remains small, provided that n times L is large compared to the strong scale of the theory. That is, sorry, 1 over nL is large compared to the strong scale of the theory.
So, sorry, don't understand your answer.
It's the only option, yes. You have to do that twisting if you want the small L physics to be, to have any chance to be smoothly connected to large volume physics. Yes, yes. That's right, that's our result. Okay? So by going through the song and dance, we construct a small L limit, which is weakly coupled and has a chance of knowing about, well, being smoothly connected to the large volume limit, which we're ultimately interested in. So you can ask, in this particular small L limit that we've constructed, are there normalons still present? Okay. Well, what would a normalon look like? It would be an ambiguity in resummations of perturbation theory of order e to the minus 1 divided by the g squared times n, because the beta function of this theory is just n with the appropriate sign. Well, on R2, actually, the integrability calculations of Kazakov, Fatih, and Wiegmann, for instance, for the ground state energy, tell you that indeed there are renormalons in the theory. There are ambiguities that look like this in the resummation of perturbation theory. So if our small L limit is adiabatic, we would expect that the size of the normal ambiguities to be roughly of this scale. So let's see if that actually happens. So when L is small, the theory looks like quantum mechanics. You can describe this particular two-dimensional QFT by a one-dimensional effective field theory, which is quantum mechanics. But with a funny twisted boundary condition along the way on the circle. And so you pick some field variables to parameterize our SUN matrix. Here we use some Hopf parameterization. And when the smoke clears, here's the small L effective theory with, the twisted boundary conditions being reflected in the presence of this term here. Now, what we'd like to do is to compute the ground state energy as a function of the coupling constant and look at its asymptotics. And in quantum mechanics, you can actually do this systematically, unlike in QFT, where this is pretty hard. And when you do, what you find is that at large order, the perturbative expansion behaves as follows. Fortunately, somebody else examined the right quantum mechanics before us. We could steal their answer. We can also check it. So the large order behavior of the perturbative series for the ground state energy has a factorial growth with a particular weight, with particular corrections. But this factorial growth is not sign alternating. So that means that this is a non-Borel summable series for the ground state energy. And what I'm plotting here is the ratio of the exact results for the perturbative coefficients for low n from, I don't know, like 4 out to 12 divided by this asymptotic form. And you can see that they approach each other. Well, you can try to Borel sum this. You will fail. You'll have to deform your contour. And you'll get a resummation ambiguity of this form. Okay. So notice that once you've, the form of the ambiguity is e to the minus some number divided by the Tuft coupling, g squared n. So this is precisely what we would expect if renormalons had survived this particular small L limit. Okay. But then the question is, what do you make of this term, the red term? We have a stable system. The ground state energy has to be real. But this is something imaginary. And worse than that, it's ambiguous in sign. So this can't be a part of the correct physical expression for the ground state energy. Something has to cancel it. The question is what? And if the story I told you at the beginning of the talk is correct, then it has to be canceled by some contribution from the non-perturbative sector of the theory. But then what could that be? This theory has no instantons. Okay. Well, it turns out that it does have finite action configurations. They're just not standard topological ones. Mathematicians back in the mid-80s found finite action solutions in the theory, which they called unitons. And they do have finite action. For instance, the minimal uniton has action 8 pi divided by g squared. But this thing would give an ambiguity of order e to the minus s uniton. Notice there's no n there. So that's not helpful to us. Now, this is on R2. If we go to R setting, which is R times S1 with twisted boundary conditions, something interesting happens. The unitons turn out to fractionalize into n constituents. And you can actually find the field configurations associated with these constituents. In this small L effective theory, here's what the fractional unitons look like. Call them fractons. So they're just kinks. Okay, it's just quantum mechanics. So whatever these things are, they're some kind of instanton-like objects. But their action is 1/n that of a uniton. And in the SUN theory, there are n types of minimal action fractons. I've just shown you solutions for SU2 because they're easy to write. There are n minus 1 fractons associated to the n minus 1 simple roots of SUN. And then there's another one called the KK fracton, which is associated to the affine root of SUN. This is very analogous to what happens in gauge theory on R3 times S1. If you have Zn symmetric boundary, if you have a Zn symmetric gauge field in Yang-Mills theory on R3 times S1, then an instanton fractionalizes into n monopole instantons, one of which is the KK monopole instanton. So this is an analogous story in two dimensions in the principal chiral model. Yes?
Is each dimension a localized object, or are they particles going on the
spectrum? No, they really have finite, they have finite action. We have a time direction which is non-compact.
I understand. How does that one scale? Does that one scale with the size of the circle at all?
No, it does not. So the action is just 8 pi divided by g squared n. So these things exist for any L as long as you have a twisted boundary condition. They exist classically as long as you solve the classical equations of motion.
I'm just trying to figure out. So there was an L over g squared in S?
Oh, yeah, sorry. But there's another L buried inside this parameter. So in the end, the action of these things is L independent. It's L independent. So it is. OK. So the unitons are actually composites of these things. OK, but having found fractional instanton-like configurations, you have to still ask, how in the world can they give ambiguous contributions? I mean, they are what they are. They contribute to the pattern, you really would think. Why should they be ambiguous? We're at weak coupling because we're at small circle size. And once we're at weak coupling, then you can think about the contributions of instantons using dilute instanton gas approximation. In our case, it's the dilute fracton gas, but it's the same thing. Okay? And then you can think of the contributions as falling into one of two classes from the non-perturbative sector. One is the contributions from arbitrarily widely separated fracton events, okay? Very, very widely separated instanton-like events. And those will not have any ambiguities associated with them. But there can also be correlated multifracton events where there's a fracton over here, another fracton somewhere else, but they're not too far apart. So such events can also happen, and they're qualitatively different. And some of those events have ambiguity associated with them. So let me explain how that works briefly. So, okay, you could have a fracton event taking place right here, which is at some tunneling amplitude. Then some amount of Euclidean time passes, and you tunnel back. Okay? So that's a fracton antifracton event. So if the separation between these two Euclidean times is large, this will be a quasi-saddle point of the path integral up to exponentially small corrections. And then, T1 plus T2 is going to be a zero mode of this particular saddle point. And T1 minus T2 will be almost a zero mode, because you can move them closer or farther, and the action cost is very, very small. And then, of course, there are Gaussian fluctuations on top of that. Okay. Or you could have a tunneling event, and nothing happens for a while, and then some other tunneling event. Now, so far, everything I've said would apply also to arbitrarily widely separated events. But when you do the integral over these quasi-zero modes, you discover that the system has an extra scale in it, which is associated to the correlation scale between events, which is related to the log of the coupling constant. So in particular, when you do the summation over the quasi-zero modes, it turns out to be localized somewhere. And the localization scale is log of 1 over the coupling constant. So what I'm showing here is the quasi-zero mode integral for a fracton-fracton event. Okay? And it is unambiguous. You can just compute the amplitude And here.
So in here, mm-hmm. you got, this contribution is the contribution to what? The energy, the...
For instance, to the ground state energy. To the ground state energy.
And you're in the dilute limit.
And you're in the dilute limit, yes.
Okay, so you just look at the fracton.
Yes.
The fracton.
Fracton and another fracton. This.
Okay.
Okay? But another kind of contribution you could have is fracton antifracton.
And then you're looking at the perturbation theory around that.
And then you could look at the perturbation theory around that. Yeah. So I have
what you're computing here.
So what I'm computing here is, so let me be careful. Perturbation theory around some finite action saddle point, we normally think of that as Gaussian fluctuations and then corrections to that.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm showing here is something which is a bit different from that. It's
mm-hmm.
Quasi-zero mode fluctuations, which are not Gaussian. So
you're saying there's an extra zero mode integral.
There's an extra almost zero mode.
Okay.
So the fact that it's
this way you get this log.
This is where you get the log. Something over that not quite zero mode is where you pick up the log.
And then you would get Gaussian fluctuations.
And then you also have Gaussian fluctuations you would have to take care of.
But this
that's
log
right.
is going to be important for this log.
Hmm?
This log is going to be important.
This log is very important for me. That's right.
Okay. So that's you're saying okay, because this is where your imaginary part.
That's where the imaginary part is going to come from. That's right.
So you need to have this kind of quasi.
You
so
need to have this quasi zero mode, yeah. That's right.
So you're saying that, okay, you need to have in this non-perturbative contribution some extra degrees of freedom that are not, yeah, this quasi. So this quasi-zero mode are what, the separations? Or?
The separations of the events, yeah. You don't really add them. I mean, they're there. You could have, I mean, you know, this is an event, finite action event. But then,
yeah.
after a while, there's another one.
And what is this quasi-localization mechanism? Which gives
okay,
you
so what so
direction?
It doesn't quite okay. So that's for this one. So what's behind it is you subtract off the uncorrelated part of the amplitude, and the correlated part of it has this localization. Yeah.
How can I think of this as like an extra interaction?
Okay. So if you have a fracton event or instanton event. So they have a repulsive interaction between them. So they can lower their action by getting further apart. Okay? So that explains why the integrand here, which is what I'm plotting, goes to zero with large tau. That does not, by itself, explain why it's dropping to zero here. Okay? Now, what's going on is that I have subtracted off the contribution of the uncorrelated events. Let me say it another way. Is there a truck? Yes. So suppose I want to compute an instanton-instanton-like amplitude. Well, that's going to have an overall weight of e to the minus 2 s instanton. And then I have to take into account the contribution of the quasi-zero mode. So that's going to be writable as an integral over the separation between these things. And e to the interaction action between them, which turns out to look like, turns out to look like this, okay, with the appropriate sign choice, and then I can do this, okay, I can add one and subtract one, okay. So what's going on is the following: this thing here is the contribution of very widely separated instances. And this part here is like the first coefficient in the virial expansion. It's the contribution from correlated ones. And this minus 1 is connected to why I have this localization, okay, in the correlated events. I hope that helps. Okay? But everything I said works for basically instanton-instanton type events, fracton-fracton. It doesn't work for fracton-antifracton events, which turn out to be the interesting ones. Because if you have something like tunneling, anti-tunneling, okay, then that has an effective attractive interaction, not a repulsive interaction. So what they really want to do is they want to get on top of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't make any sense within the range of approximations that we're using, because we've assumed a dilute gas approximation. So that's bad. Okay. So we have to deal with that. But it's actually a blessing in disguise. Because to make sense of it, all we have to do is to give the coupling constant an imaginary part. We had to do that anyway to make sense of perturbation theory. OK? Okay, to do Borel summation, we have to do these contour deformations, which is equivalent to giving coupling constants imaginary parts. Well, we have to do the same thing here. Okay, and upon doing this, the quasi-zero mode integrals become well-defined. You can just do them. But then you have to continue back to positive real coupling. And you get an ambiguity, basically, from this law. Okay. The ambiguity looks as follows. The detailed numbers here are not so important, except you have to get them right, because now this is the ambiguity coming from the perturbative sector. We want to compare it to the ambiguity that we got coming from the perturbative sector, with all of the signs right and all of the prefactors right. And when you do, it turns out that they cancel each other precisely in the Gramsci energy, for instance. Okay? So that tells you something quite dramatic. Perturbation theory knew about the existence of these non-perturbative saddle points. It knew their action. And it knew exactly how they would contribute, because that's the only way this cancellation could have happened. This is, in my view, pretty dramatic. It's telling us that there is exact information about non-perturbative physics buried in perturbation theory, but in a coded form. And using this kind of approach, we've decoded it. Okay.
So you're saying the fracton-fracton doesn't?
Fracton-fracton gives unambiguous contributions.
Okay, even if you can.
Yeah, I mean, they contribute depending on to which observable, but so some things they don't contribute to, some things they do. But fracton-antifracton always contributes to the same things as perturbation theory. And it's actually ambiguous.
And there's a divergence there.
There's a divergence there. Instant time, anti-instant time to go on top of each other, that gives you issues. When you deal with that in the same way that you deal with it in perturbation theory, by giving the coupling constant and small imaginary part, then rotating back after you've done the resulting integrals, you have complete ambiguity cancellation.
And it's the opposite sign.
It's the opposite sign, exactly, in the same prefactor. That's right. That's right. OK. Now, what we've just seen is a cancellation of an imaginary part. Okay? But we were calculating an observable, which we knew to be real. So you might have had the following perspective. You calculate something you know to be real. You get something small and imaginary. Just throw it out. Because it's small and imaginary, you know it can't be there. So at this order, you would have gotten the right answer by doing that. Okay? But actually, if you go to higher order in the semiclassical expansion, such a naive approach of just throwing out imaginary ambiguities would lead you very far astray. Because, so here's an expression for the Gramsci energy in terms of the resummation of perturbation theory using Borel summation, and then the contribution of the fracton-antifracton saddle point and the fluctuations around that. And then at some high enough order in semiclassical expansion, it turns out that the imaginary ambiguity associated with this contribution is actually multiplied by some other imaginary ambiguity coming from this contribution. And the product is actually real and unambiguous. And that contributes to the physical observable, which is to say that you can't just throw out ambiguities. You really have to understand them, because they can actually contribute in a physical way at some higher order in the expansion. Now, I advertised early on that there would be some connection to the mass gap, and there is, because the mass gap is just the splitting between the ground state and the first excited state. We're in a position to calculate that using our small effective theory. That splitting is driven by the one fracton amplitude. It's just like an instant time amplitude. And in the SUN case, the mass gap looks like this in the smaller limit in which we're working. Notice that it goes like e to the minus 1 over the tilt coupling, as you would expect in a matrix-like theory. But notice this factor, e to the minus 8 pi over lambda. The size of their normal ambiguity is exactly sort of the square of that. It's e to the minus 2 times 8 pi minus lambda. So that does not seem to be an accident, actually. In every example that we've looked at where there is a smaller limit of this sort, the principal chiral model, the CPN minus 1 models, Yang-Mills theory on R3 times S1, every example, the mass gap is, the size of the mass gap is the size of the normal ambiguity to the 1/2 power, okay? In this sense, this 8 pi versus this 2 8 pi. And that continues to be true when you add massless fermions to the theory, which changes dramatically both this expression in a way that I won't have time to talk about. So let me summarize, because I'm running out of time. Even when there's no topology, naively, to support the presence of finite action saddle points, resurgence theory predicts that they must be there if perturbation theory has resummation ambiguities. And it tells you what they should look like. And once you have that information, you can actually find them. Moreover, in the semi-classical domain, once you've found the non-perturbative saddle points, you can show that normal ambiguities cancel against contributions of the non-perturbative saddle points, which are typically non-BPS. Renormalins turn out to be close related to the mass gap, as it Hoof dreamt, and all of our results so far are consistent with the resurgent nature of observables in quantum field theories with weak coupling limits. But there's a lot left to do. We're just beginning to explore this. So there appear to be very interesting relations between the things I was telling you about and the analytic continuation of path integrals, which has been recently explored by Witt and other people. The Lefschetz symbol decomposition of integration cycles that Witten discusses in papers over the last 4 years or so appears to geometrize resurgence. So we're trying to work that out now. But there are actually likely to be many practical implications of this as well as some of the things that I've mentioned. For instance, resurgence theory together with this technology of Lefschetz symbols plays a vital role in seeing how instantons appear in real-time path integrals, something that we recently understood. It gives you improved understanding of connections between strong and weak coupling limits, as we've been exploring together with Peter Kuratiev, who would normally be here. And people are recently beginning to explore applications of resurgence theory in supersymmetric gauge theories. That's at a fairly early stage, but there's a recent paper by Ines Aniceto, Jorge Russo, and Ricardo Schiappa on that. There are probably many other applications, but let me stop with that. Thank you.
Yeah, how would you get the asymptotics of the perturbative perturbation theory behavior?
Okay, so for Yang-Mills theory, as you probably know, this is a big problem. I don't know how to compute closures in perturbation theory. I don't think anybody really does. I mean, there are interesting modern ways to compute higher, amplitude-based techniques. But if you want to go to really high loop orders, this is very hard. So that's actually one reason that we picked this particular example, these two-dimensional examples. Because if you want to understand how things are fitting together before attacking Yang-Mills theory, if you look at two-dimensional theories, then in the limit that we can study these two-dimensional theories, they're describable by quantum mechanical field theories. And in quantum mechanics, you really do know how to compute large orders. It's fairly straightforward. You just do Bender Wu type analyses. And so in this context, we can see very sharp we can do very sharp computations and see how things cancel and so on. In higher dimensional quantum field theories, you can't quite do as much, precisely because you don't know how to directly compute large orders in perturbation theory. You can estimate them, people do that, but you can't just shut up and talk about it. At least I don't know how to do it.
I have a question about Tough Dream. How did he manage to get there? I mean, this is pretty. So automatons are, I think of them as particular Feynman diagrams with certain properties that maybe you can recall. And then what did he do to have these dreams? What's the physical picture behind his intuition?
Okay.
I mean, I don't
know. Okay. I'm not completely sure what really was what he was thinking. I can tell you how I would think about it, which is that suppose you have some asymptotically free quantum field theory with a mass gap, and you compute some two-point correlation. Okay. Well, if you want to compute it in perturbation theory, you need to have a large external momentum. So suppose you've arranged that, and you do perturbation theory. Perturbation theory in an asymptotically free theory is an expansion in the log of the log of the momentum. Okay? So transfer, then the perturbative expansion is an expansion in the log of Q, roughly. Okay? But you know that correlation functions like this that there's actually a mass gap in the problem. Okay? So in this correlator, there have to be corrections that look like, have to be contributions that look like the strong scale or the mass gap scale divided by Q to some powers. But perturbation theory looks like this. Okay? So if the thing is going to be self-consistent, then perturbation theory should have a divergence in it, some growth, which is factorial, and which should involve a factor of the beta function, such that the ambiguity will look like of this scale, which, as you know from considerations of these bubble diagrams, which I will mention briefly, is exactly what happens. They point at power corrections. Those power corrections have to do with the fact that the theory has a mass gap that's confined to itself. Whether this is exactly what Atul had in mind, I'm not completely sure. But that's how I would look at it.
Okay.
Let's think like expectations.